everybody. Program note once again. We now post this show every single day. Used to do it weekly. Now we're doing it daily. We hold no punches here, not like the other guys. So look for it. Truth bomb number one. Iran retaliates with an attack that seems more like kabuki theater. Truth bomb number two. Bibi Netanyahu's most dangerous game. Truth bomb number three. Dick Cheney for president? Who's saying that? I'm going to tell you. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. Okay, let's get started with what you need to know about this retaliatory strike by Iran on Israel. By the way, the key word there? Retaliatory. Let me say it again. Retaliatory. And if by some chance you see or read reports on this in some other news platform, plenty of them, and they don't key in on that term, that word, well then stop reading or turn them off because they're lying and they're spinning you, okay? So yes, Iran fired some supposed 300 projectiles, some combination of drones and missiles, none of them precision-guided, by the way. They also seized some cargo ship, which happened to have some, 17 Indian nationals on board, something India didn't like, by the way.
On board the ship was 17 Indian nationals. Now, the UK Maritime Trade Operations said the vessel was seized 92 kilometers northeast of Fujairah, an area close to the Strait of Hormuz that forms the entrance to the Gulf.
Now, I mention that because this is the kind of thing where third countries like India can get caught up in this kind of these types of actions without intended consequences, of course. And it's why the world is on edge and the world should be on edge. The Iranian attack was a show of force. But let me play with those words a little bit. Let me just play a little bit here, if you'll allow me, right? To make a point. It was a show of force, but in actuality, not so much force as it was show. What am I saying? Yes, Iran looked tough with its missile attack into Israel, which appeased many of its citizens, as you saw in some of these celebrations on the streets of Tehran. But as we look at these folks, who obviously are saying, finally, our government did what it needed to do, was Iran truly trying to effect maximum damage on its nemesis? Think of that question I just asked. Was it trying to effect maximum damage on its nemesis, Israel? The answer is obviously no, it was not. In fact, Iran gave ample warning. It put out a statement that after its volley, it would expect that both sides, all sides really, because it was talking to the United States as well, would consider this matter resolved. This is it. We're done. No more. Let's not fight anymore. Also, if Iran were really serious, if it really wanted to inflict maximum harm, wouldn't it have used more deadly weapons? Which it has, by the way. It would also not have given the U.S. and Israel a five-hour heads up. You know, like imagine you're going to hit somebody and you say, I'm going to hit you. 5 hours of that. In fact, the missile attack only injured one person, according to the reports I've seen. It may change. 99% of the projectiles were intercepted. Now, were the U.S. and Israel in on this kabuki dance? It sure seems like it. Oh, and by the way, don't be fooled when you hear reports from the State Department or the Pentagon, delivered, of course, by their PR agents in the national U.S. media, like this one.
A U.S. official with direct knowledge of the conflict in Israel tells CBS News President Biden told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu America will not participate in a retaliatory strike on Iran following Saturday's drone and missile attack.
Okay, that, what you just heard right there, is at minimum a deceptive statement. And here's why. Who do you think is shooting down those incoming drones and missiles? We are, the United States of America. I'm a block from the White House, as I like to say. That decision was made to do that there. Our military is very much involved in this already. And though it seems at this point like both sides are doing their best to let this be a momentary bar fight, it's important to compare these two attacks at this point. In other words, what got us here, right? What got us to this place where we are right now? First, and let's not forget, the Israeli attack on an Iranian embassy.
An Israeli airstrike destroyed a building belonging to Iran's embassy in Damascus, according to Iranian state media. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said one of their senior commanders was among the dead. Israel's military didn't comment, but it's thought to regularly strike Iran-linked targets.
Did you hear what you just said? They regularly strike Iran-linked targets. I mean, that language makes it sound like it's no big deal. No big deal? One country, without notice, bombs another country? That's a violation of international law. Oh, they also destroy an embassy that belongs to a third country? That's a violation of the Vienna Convention, at least. Then they assassinate not one, but two Iranian officials? That's a violation of every law known to man. Oh, yeah, they regularly do this, says CBS or whatever. So let's play this out. Let's play out this comparison again. Israel bombs an embassy, killing many, including Israeli officials. Pardon me, including many. Stop there, right? Israeli officials, right? And Iran now comes in and sends missiles meant to shoot down others and injures one person. So on the one hand, you have somebody bombing an embassy in another country and assassinating leaders. On the other hand, you have a country saying, oh, by the way, we're going to shoot a bunch of missiles, but we're going to give you notice so you can shoot them all down. Which is more serious? Which was done with actual malice? You tell me. But here's an even more important question that brings us to the real wild card in all of this, which should be concerning to the entire world. The question is why? We know that Israel started this latest situation, but why? Why did they start it, or better said, why did he start it? And by he, I mean Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. The Prime Minister, by all indications, can only keep his job, stay in office, and even avoid going to jail for corruption so long as he can prolong and escalate his country's war footing. Continuing the war in Gaza, killing Palestinians, right, is in fact not good for the U.S., but it is good for the Prime Minister. And what about starting a war between Iran and the United States? Starting a war between Iran and the United States, that would obviously be horrible for us, for the United States. It would endanger the lives of countless U.S. men and women in uniform, not to mention the citizens of Iran and the soldiers of Iran as well. But once again, it wouldn't be so bad for the Prime Minister.
You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. And we do remember, and we are fighting our brave troops and combatants who are now in Gaza.
That is Netanyahu using the Hebrew Bible as a reference point and reason to kill Palestinians and perhaps others. What he seems to be suggesting is that the Amalekites and their descendants, presumably the Palestinians in this case, are said to be cursed and forever and must be eliminated for what they did to ancient Israel. If it sounds crazy to you, it sounds crazy to a whole lot of people around the world. But while most see that type of talk as dangerous, from a Karl Rovian perspective, it's actually very effective. Karl Rove, you may remember, was the U.S. advisor to President George W. Bush, who openly talked about how the disastrous Iraq war was good for the president's approval ratings. He was right. Do you know who and when U.S. presidents achieved the highest approval ratings of all time here in the history of our country, the United States? Let me help you. According to Gallup, I just looked it up, the highest was President Truman after he dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima to scare Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. His approval rating soared to 87%. Did anyone surpass that? Has anyone surpassed that? Yes. George W. Bush had the highest approval ratings ever in our country. When? After he sent troops into Iraq and Afghanistan. His approval rating passed Truman's. And with the help of the media, it hit 90%. 90%. Joining us now to talk about it, somebody who I consider a perfect guest for this conversation, may disagree, by the way, with some of the things I said, Professor Mohammad Mirandi. He's also, by the way, he's a professor at the University of Tehran and has been a frequent guest on this show. We're also joined by Esteban Carrillo. I'm showing off and pronouncing my R's that way. We could say Esteban Carrillo. He's an editor for Online News magazine, The Cradle. Gentlemen, I'm not sure where I want to begin, but I guess, Professor, I'm going to start with you. I said a lot there, but I did find it that it seemed to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Iran did everything possible to attack while not really attacking. Am I right?
I would say that the strike was very calculated and carefully managed, and that it could have been much more severe and very deadly. But it wasn't simply a spectacle. What the Iranians did in response to the Israeli aggression on Iranian sovereignty in Syria, and the attack on the embassy, was that the Iranians warned everyone beforehand what they wanted to do, and then they sent a large number of drones towards Israel. But the drones were old drones. None of them were the more modern and more technologically developed drones. So they were very cheap, and they had no technology that could be compromised. And therefore, when those drones reached Israel, the Iranians knew that the Americans would, and you're absolutely correct, the Americans played the main role in downing most of the drones and the missiles. The Iranians knew that these drones would be attacked and that they would be downed. But that was the objective. The Iranians wanted the Americans and the Israelis to use their most advanced technology because they're very expensive and their limited number of missiles, and also because their best technology. So Iran gained a lot of intelligence.
So can you characterize for me the thinking behind that? Because you're right. It looks to me like Iran was very careful, tactical, almost mechanical in the way they approached this. They wanted to make noise, but they didn't want to make too much noise. They wanted to get attention, but they didn't want to get that much attention. They wanted to hurt Israel, but they didn't want to destroy Israel or even come close to it. What is the mindset in Tehran, do you believe, Professor? You're there, you talk to people, behind this type of approach?
Well, there are two things. One is that, as I said, they wanted to deplete their weapon systems, their missiles. They wanted to learn about their capabilities.
Okay.
And the Israelis and the Americans, by estimates put forward by the Israelis, spent over $1.3 billion. Whereas the Iranian drones and a series of missiles that were old again, none of them had Iran's key technologies, they were also fired. Those were also down, but all of these were decoys. And then there were between 10 and 20 missiles that were sent, that were fired, that were directed towards two targets, one in the north, an intelligence gathering center, and one, an air base in the south that was used to attack the embassy and also to carry out the genocide in Gaza. Those missiles got through. And so the serious missiles, which were somewhere between 10 and 20, they all made it through. But all of the others that were decoys, and all of them combined probably cost like $10-15 million. I don't know the actual number, but which is
a tiny number compared to what we usually talk about in military terms. Esteban, let me bring you into this. I want to ask you a question about Bibi Netanyahu. I'm going to share with you something that I believe as an American that I think my country should say to Bibi Netanyahu. And it's something probably akin to this. If you continue for your own political purposes or for whatever purposes you may think of, Mr. Netanyahu, if you continue trying to start a war between us, the United States, and Iran, we are A, going to hold you accountable for that. We are not going to respond. We are going to stop giving you funding for anything else you do, and we may consider breaking the relations that we presently have with your country. Why is it so hard for my country to say that to someone who seems to be acting like an outlaw?
They seem to be trying to get to that point, no? When you hear Joe Biden, he's so angry now at Netanyahu. When you see all the Western media all of a sudden trying to make the issue, the genocide in Gaza, a result of the policies of one man, of the decisions of one man, instead of the Zionist project, instead of the 75-year history of the occupation of Palestine, mm-hmm. that tells you that Netanyahu have, so his days counted, so to speak. But then again, Netanyahu
Esteban, hold on a minute. Even now, there's nothing close. This, what were the first words out of Joe Biden's mouth when he heard that there had been this somewhat lucid attack by Iran on Israel this weekend? The first words out of his mouth were something like to the effect that we stand behind 100% Israel, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Instead of being at least a little more tepid and saying something like, we understand this is a difficult situation and we really wish Israel had not attacked Iran to spur this on, but nonetheless, we will help Israel in any way we can. I would understand something like that. But the immediate response was, we're ready to go to war for Israel if we have to. That just seemed childish and stupid to me. Tell me how I'm wrong.
Indeed. No, you're not. Indeed. They were from ironclad. That's what Biden said. Today, one of the government officials called it sacrosanct. This is the level that they will go to defend Israel against the rest of the world. So I feel like at this point, Joe Biden is a man that is even willing to give up his own campaign, his own reelection, just to protect Israel, just to get dragged down into a war with Iran, right? That in the end, for U.S. planners, seems like something inevitable just because of what Iran represents to the region of West Asia, which is, not living under a hegemonic order, not living under a unipolar order.
Yeah.
And it's the same threat that China and Russia represent.
There are so many people in this country who are now starting to see the difference between real threats and made-up threats. And maybe that's what we need to talk about. When we take a quick break, I want to come back and ask Professor Mirandi about that. The perception of what the United States is intending to do or should do. And is there a difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration when it comes to this matter? Remember, President Trump assassinated a Iranian leader. So what is the difference? We're going to talk about that. Stay right there. We're going to be right back.
To shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
We need to counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
За стеной ту-ту-ту-ту-ту, вот эта вот очередь автоматная.
И сразу так мысль, тум, все, убили.
Обернулся, увидел людей, которые все еще находились рядом со мной. Всем крикнул за мной и побежал на улицу.
Все уходите в ту сторону, туда, 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 туда.
Там герой был каждый.
Но он мне вслед прокричал, и я буду молиться за вас.
Все объединились, и я думаю, что если бы наши люди были не такие, то жертв было бы гораздо больше.
У нас очень сочувственный народ, который всю беду всегда через себя пропускает.
Душа болит, сердце болит. Ну как это не попрощаться с людьми, которые погибли здесь?
Y'all probably heard my little sister's story, Kaylin, the model girl that had got killed. Y'all probably seen it all over the news on 73rd, man. She got shot in the drive-by shooting.
My brother Terrell, he was shot and killed while helping a friend unload drums into the church. So now I never look at churches as being a safe ground.
I got shot and lost my leg. That's the outcome of it, but everything's still the same. Ain't nothing changed.
The Chicago police is the biggest gang in Chicago. It's like, when you get pulled over by police, you literally think your life is over, man.
That's another crime scene. Another one lost. So this could have been a doctor, a nurse, could have been the next president. But we can't keep losing our people out here.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. And I am joined by Professor Mohammad Mirandi from Tehran, as well as Esteban Carrillo. And my thanks to both of you gentlemen. Professor, let me begin with you. By the way, I wasn't trying to leave the impression, in case you may have gotten that at the beginning, that I wanted Iran to fire hell and brimstone into Israel and punish every person. No, that's not what I was trying to say. I just wanted to comment on the calculated and careful way in which this whole thing was addressed. Maybe more importantly is, now that Esteban and I, and you overheard us talking about the reaction from the Biden administration, which I thought was a bit tepid, how do you see the Biden administration thus far's reaction to all things Iran? You and I had a good chance to talk back when, during the Trump administration, I thought Trump was really hard on Iran, in some cases more stern, perhaps unnecessary, maybe even a little unjust. Do you see a difference here, or is it same old, as we say here?
Well, when it comes to Iran, the U.S. political establishment and the mainstream media, they've always been very irrational. And they basically have been influenced by the Zionist lobby. Mm. And their influence is extraordinary. When the United States supports a genocide in Gaza, then it's obvious that the United States is going to support any atrocity that the Israeli regime carries out. And of course, since the Iranians have always been the key supporters of the Palestinian cause, there's no country in the region or in the world that seriously supports the Palestinian people in their resistance against the occupation and against ethnic cleansing. So obviously, U.S. hostility and Israeli hostility will be focused on Iran. And that, of course, whether it's Trump or Obama or Biden or Bush, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. Obama imposed maximum pressure sanctions to target ordinary Iranians. Trump did the same to target ordinary Iranians. Biden has continued with the maximum pressure sanctions. All of them have spoken about all options being on the table. And of course, Bush as well. So there really has been a continuity when it comes to Iran. But the problem for the United States is that now they're pushing the region towards a very dangerous situation. One thing that has changed after the attack on the Iranian embassy is that the Iranians have now declared that the equation has changed. If the Israelis attack Iranians anywhere, not inside Iran, not just inside Iran or in embassies, anywhere from now on, Iran is going to hit back at the Israeli regime directly, and they will attack them very hard.
Do you consider, let me ask you the question from your point of view. Do you believe that Iran considers that when it is attacking full flow or full throttle the Israelis, they're really just as well getting ready to be attacked back by both Israelis and the United States? In other words, do they perceive a war with Israel as a war with America?
Well, if the United States strikes Iran, then the Iranians will strike back at the Americans very hard. And the Iranians have been preparing for two decades. They have drone bases and missile bases across the country, underground bases. And they have been designed to protect Iran from the United States. If the United States attacks, the Iranians will expel the U.S. from Iraq using their capabilities, but also their allies in Iraq will overrun U.S. bases, and their bases in Syria would collapse too because they're dependent on their occupation in Iraq. But more importantly, Iran will strike U.S. bases across the Persian Gulf, and even more important than that, Iran will strike those countries that host U.S. bases because they'll be seen as complicit. And if that happens, that means there will be no oil and gas coming from the Persian Gulf region, not just the Persian Gulf, but the region. And that would lead to a global economic catastrophe that will be worse than 1929. So I think there's a sort of balance of terror between Iran and the United States, sort of like between the Soviet Union and the United States. And that's what I think is deterring the United States. And I think there are a lot of sane people and still sane people in Washington who recognize that. So that perhaps may be a bridge too far, but of course, the United States today is not being rational at all. The very fact that the United States is supporting the Israelis carry out the genocide is demolishing the U.S. Across the world. It's destroying its soft power, it's destroying its credibility, its reputation, its image, but the United States seemed, and the Europeans seem willing to sacrifice everything for the Israelis.
About a minute left, Esteban, and I want to come back to you and ask you this question about this situation that Professor and I were just talking about. Do you think, as a student of the United States and its political policies, that there is something within the United States that could get it away from this mindset of war, even perhaps those who think it would be good? People like John Bolton, for example, who recently said he wants Dick Cheney to be the next president. Imagine that. Can separate us from that war-type mindset that we have right now. Do you see it?
I don't. I don't, Rick. I know you hope that maybe I would say a different answer, but I do not, because this is sadly the history of the United States over the past, 50, 60 years. Just war and more war and more war. Why? Because war is profitable. Because everybody else may be suffering, but the weapon companies, your Lockheed Martins, your RTX, your Northrop Grumman, they're all laughing all the way to the bank. And this is also one of the reasons why, this big support for Israel, and all of a sudden they want to revive this package for Ukraine and Israel, $60 billion. Where's the dollars going to go? They're going to go into the pockets of the weapons, somewhere else. So you need to be looking at the stockholders, Who are the stockholders of these companies? And then see where the change can begin.
Yeah, you know, you just made me think of a line, and maybe I should coin it, but it's almost like I was just having a conversation with both of you, including the professor, about the United States of America and its position. But as you just reminded us, it's not so much the United States of America anymore, it's the national security states of America. And that's a problem that we're going to have to fix down the line if we want to all get along better. I'm out of time. My thanks to both of you, as usual. Professor Morandi, good to see you again, my friend. Thank you so much for sharing your insight with us. And as usual, good to be with you as well, Esteban. Thank you very much. Before I go, I want to remind you of our mission here. What we try to do, anyway, pretty simple. De-silo the world. We've got to stop living in these little boxes. Truths don't live in boxes. Truths are everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. It's what we're shooting for here on Direct Impact.